This is the Equip Podcast from Cornerstone Church of Ames, a podcast designed to help you live a gospel-fueled and faithful life wherever Jesus has called you.
Welcome again to the Equip Podcast from Cornerstone Church. My name is Mark Vance. I am the lead pastor here at Cornerstone Church, and it's a pleasure to be with you. And today I want to talk about hymns. H-Y-M-N-S, which, by the way, that's a five-letter word, and I anticipate that is going to be on Wordle at some point. So if you guys are into that Wordle stuff, I'm just giving you a hint. I think that's going to be on there. Okay, back on subject. I'm talking about the great songs of the faith. Hymns are a treasure. In some ways, hymns and the study of hymns or the history of hymns, you could call it hymnody is the technical word, is something that, for me, has been a subject of, I don't know, kind of the songs of my life. I grew up in a traditional church where we sang using the Peterson Great Hymns of the Faith hymn book. I can still recall like the number, the hymn number of many of the hymns, and I grew up loving to sing. It was how I learned to sing and how I learned to worship. And so what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about why the great hymns of the faith are important, and just reflect a little bit about why treasuring the songs of the faith is so important and why there's a concern in our modern day around that. And even I want to acknowledge at the outset a concern in a, you know, hip, cool, trendy, worshiping church like Cornerstone, particularly. What sparks this conversation is I recently returned from a time away at a conference in Houston and had some time to speak with Robert J. Morgan. He's a noted pastor and author, and he's actually written a number of songs about, or rather a number of books about hymnody, about the study of hymns. He's written one of his daily devotions called A Song in My Heart, where every day for a full year, he reflects on the story behind one of the great hymns of the faith. It's a really great little devotional book, and he just has this deep well of knowledge about hymns. And as we spoke a little bit over a time at lunch, David Livingston, one of the planters in our network, he asked a question. He said, "Why are hymns so important, and what would you want a young church to know about them?" And I thought that was just such a great question. It prompted a wonderful discussion. I thought, this is something that I wonder if we should reflect on a little bit together. And on the Equip Podcast this week. So let's talk about that. Why are hymns so important, and why is it the church collects songs over time? Well, the first thing to say is this pattern of us singing songs that are both old and new is an ancient pattern for the Christian church. We've always been a singing people, and in every generation of the church, there have been both new songs that are rising out of the movement of the Spirit at that time, but also old songs that are a reflection of the faithfulness of God over time. This has been on my mind a lot, actually, as we've taught through the book of Psalms at Cornerstone. One of the interesting reflections that you have, if you study the book of Psalms and you look at it as a piece of literature, 150 books, is that these Psalms were written by many different people over many different eras, and they reflect a wide variety of experiences in the history of Israel as a nation. So, for instance, Psalm 90 is a psalm written by Moses, the great deliverer of Israel that brought them out of Egypt in the Exodus. So the dating of that song of Moses, most scholars are going to say that was written, let's say, 1400 to 1200, somewhere in that time frame, BC, before Christ. You then go forward and you have psalms like Psalm 72. That's a psalm written by Solomon. There are tons of psalms written by David. Those psalms would be written toward the beginning of the kingship of Israel. But then you have a psalm like Psalm 137. That might be one that you might not be as familiar with. But Psalm 137, it speaks particularly about the concern of Israel in exile. I'll read just a little bit of it. The beginning of Psalm 137 says, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion." When we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees, for our tormentors there asked us for songs, our tormentors for rejoicing. Sing us one of the songs of Zion, they said. How can we sing the Lord's song on a foreign soil? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I don't remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem as my greatest joy. Okay, do you see what that song is written and sung by the rivers of Babylon? That would mean it's sung when the children of Israel are in exile in Babylon, which happens at 586 BC. Okay, so let's just do a little math here. That means that from the Song of Moses, Psalm 90, which is written in, let's say, 1400 BC, we then have a song like Psalm 137 that is clearly written sometime after 586 BC, all of it likely compiled by Ezra or one of the other scribes in the post-exilic era. So you have songs written over hundreds of years compiled. So you have both new songs that would have been new and fresh to the audience and old songs. My point is, the Psalms themselves show us a pattern that has been present throughout the history of the church, that God's people are a singing people. They're both singing a new song to the Lord, something that arises out of the moment where they live, right? How can I sing the songs of Zion in exile? The Psalms praising the Davidic kingship. Those were very timely. They're written for a particular moment when God's Spirit is working. But they're also, the people of God are also not only singing a new song, they're also constantly reminding themselves through very old songs that they are part of a history and a legacy of God's faithfulness that isn't just obsessed with the moment in the new. This has been true, so I give you a canonical, a scriptural reference to that in the book of Psalms, but it's been true in the pattern of the history of the church. When you have the great Reformation of Martin Luther, it burst forth in a whole bunch of new songs. Luther wrote songs, right? People like the Wesleys wrote songs. John Calvin and the Reformers in Geneva wrote many, many new songs. And when they compiled those together into the hymn book of Germany, which Luther did in his kind of German singing tradition, he not only, though, put his new songs, a song like A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, originates out of that time frame from Luther, he also includes the old songs of Ambrose and other. Luther was careful to say, I am trying to preserve the gospel. I'm trying to call us forward into a tradition that was passed down to us by Jesus, and so I'm not just going to give you things that are new, I'm going to give you songs that are old. That same thing was true in, we could think of like the gospel hymn writing era. Fanny J. Crosby was one of the great hymn writers, and when Fanny Crosby compiled the hymnals that she put together, she included not only wonderful songs that they had written in that gospel hymn era, they included old songs of the faith. Luther's own, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, that song makes it into the hymnals of the gospel era. There's new songs and old songs. New songs and old songs. And I think that there's something to be said for singing songs that last over the course of time. It's the same is true of books, okay? Books, the average book is going to sell 80% of its copies within about 3 months to a year of when it is published, okay? That's the way the modern book industry works. You have to produce new books to sell more books. That's the way it works. I'm interested in reading a lot of books that actually have sold more copies 50 years after they're written than they sold right when they were written, because that book now becomes a classic. It has something of value that is contributing, that is so potent and prominent that actually it deepens and richens over time. I think that the hymns can be like that. Great is thy faithfulness lasts. Because we need a song that reminds us that in every season, summer and winter and springtime and harvest, the faithfulness of God will be there for us. It's not just the tune that needs to be passed down. And in many ways, it's not really even ever the tune that needs to be passed down. Sing that old hymn a new way. That's fine. But we need something of the preservation of the tune. Why? So this is going to sound contradictory here. I'm okay if you change around the hymns a little bit and make them sound a little different, but not too different. The reason for that has to do with memory. We don't just sing because we like tunes. We sing because God has appointed it that songs give us a way to remember truth. Great is thy faithfulness. You can hear the tune of it, right? Great is thy faithfulness. And you'll remember the next words. O God, my Father, there is no shadow of turning with thee. Thou changest not, thy compassions they fail not. As thou hast been, thou forever wilt be. Why is it I remember those words so well? Well, it's actually because I remember the tune. The tune being consistent is part of the truth being memorable. That's why you don't change around the tunes totally when you sing the ancient hymns of the faith, because if you change them completely, you actually mess with the memory of the song. And we'll get into why memory of the song is important in a minute. So we need to sing some of those. And there's a danger right now. I hinted at it when I talked about the modern book writing movement. You know, because companies exist to sell books, they have to produce new books. Why? Because new books are how you sell books. But that doesn't mean they're producing new books because something new really needs to be written on a subject. It just means they need to sell more stuff. The same thing is true with the pressure to sell songs. That's perhaps one of the things that is most different in our era to Luther's era, is the way in which media works, the way in which selling a song works. Whether it was in my age growing up, a CD, a compact disc, if you're a recording artist and you don't record new material, you don't have anything new to market. And so the company selling the song doesn't have new material to write. And let's be very honest here. The worship song industry is a very, very costly industry to fund. They're selling a lot of things. Look, guys, Hillsong sells a lot of CDs. They sell a ton of CDs. There is a ton of money involved in, I said CDs. They have a lot of listens on Spotify. Maybe that's more contemporary, right? Worship songs, they're not just a service to the church. They are a commodity. They are something that is sold in the market. And so we shouldn't be naive to think that one of the main pressures to write new songs is not because the church needs new songs, but because we need to sell more albums. There is a market pressure to produce that which is new. That's a huge change from eras in the past. Another big change is that the songs that are being written primarily in this era aren't being produced by the theologians like Martin Luther. They're being produced by worship artists, by producers, by singer-songwriters. I'm not saying that makes them intrinsically evil. I am saying it means that we're producing the materials that are supposed to guide the depth of our soul. Many of the people writing those depth of soul materials are people who are not our deepest souls. I want to say that kindly and gently. But we need to be aware there's nothing evil to it, but that's different from what happened with the hymns of the past. It really is. And so I do think because there's an always happening pressure to get more songs out, new albums, we live in an era where one of our great problems is that we suffer from a near constant need to be entertained because we are so easily distracted. And so I know, look, guys, I lived many years in my ministry life. I was a worship leader. I selected songs to sing in worship. And I know the pressure of, well, we sang that one too much. That song is kind of starting to feel old. I mean, why exactly do we not sing Indescribable that Chris Tomlin wrote anymore? That song is incredible. It was powerful and it was good. Did somehow the song become less good? No, I just think Tomlin probably needed to sell some more albums and so he needed to write in different songs. I say that not to impugn anyone's motives or to say the new songs are automatically bad songs. What I'm saying is when we need an endless variety of new songs, we are not singing the songs enough to lodge them into our corporate memory banks as God's people. Why do you remember Great is Thy Faithfulness? Yes, it's a good song. Yes, it's a good tune. But you remember it because it got sung over and over and over and over and over and over. Repetition is how you remember something, not just for a moment, but for a lifetime. Repetition is what gets the song lodged not just into your brain, but into your bloodstream. And when there's a constant pressure to write new songs and to put new, cool, well, that song kind of feels a little stale. We need to liven it up. Well, that thinking, I was a worship leader. I thought that way, guys. I did that all the time. Why did I do that? Because my primary aim was I was thinking about the Sunday in front of me. I was thinking about the thing that was very, very, very near to me. I was not thinking about that person's deathbed. Let me explain that. I was thinking, how do I produce a Sunday service that feels fresh and new and good to people that they're engaged with? I was rarely thinking, I need to lodge a song so deep in someone's brain that when they are preparing to meet the Lord, they can sing a song in the night. That was one of the biggest things that changed in me. It's one of the biggest reasons I started singing more hymns as a worship leader was I was a pastor long enough that we had to bury people. And over, the people in our church would talk to me about a song they sang as they held the hand of their loved one as they died. And I thought, for the first time as a worship leader, I don't just need to sing good songs. I need to give people the words they're going to use, whispering to their loved one as they go to be with God. That kind of set me free from feeling pressure to get new stuff in the set list every week. It made me realize I probably needed 100, 150. I mean, think of how long the hymnals are. You don't know even any all of the hymns, right? So maybe I need 150, 200 songs as a worship leader, and I needed to sing them fairly repetitively. And if they weren't worth singing with any repetition, maybe they just weren't all that good. So I think probably as a worship leader, you probably have a base of some songs that you need to be singing forever. I hope till the day I die, we are singing In Christ Alone. That new hymn from the Gettys needs to become a hymn that lasts for a very long time. Because there's something of the truth of the gospel that's in it that I don't ever want to forget. I hope we don't forget that song. But I think there are probably, in any generation, have always been some songs that, yeah, that's not going to last forever, but you sung it because it was a beautiful song for the moment. But I do think we have the ability to look back over time a little bit and ask, great is thy faithfulness. This song has really lasted a long time. I wonder why. I wonder if we should just keep singing that. So, if you're listening to this and you're like, well, I can't really do much with this podcast, Mark. This sounds like something you should share with your worship department. Well, that's probably true. Okay, probably fair enough. But I do think if you're listening to this, I want to give you a thought today, which is this. As a Christian, I want you to remember, you're not just part of something that is new and energetic and good and cool. As a Christian, we're part of something that is very old. The Christian faith is not something I invented. It was handed to me. And I think we need ways and tools in a culture that is obsessed with the modern and the new and the novel and the trendy and the cool to remind ourselves that Christianity is not new, novel, trendy, or cool, and it doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be. At the end of the day, I think God's going to judge us on our faithfulness. Did we keep passing down to the next generation the message that was given to us? Did my grandkids hear the truth of the gospel in its purity? That's more important than did my grandkids see a neat new way to present the gospel. Christianity is an old thing. And sometimes we need to sing old hymns. We need to go back and sing the songs. We need to keep the words fresh from the past because they remind us of something that lasts beyond us, that we're part of a story that began far before we came on the scene and that will keep going until far after we have left. So a couple things to think about. I think there are some modern producers and songwriters who are doing an amazing job of keeping some of the old songs alive. I think of Keith and Kristen Getty, Stuart Townend, Matt Papa, Matt Boswell. Those are just a few that you could put into your Spotify or, you know, Apple Music, whatever you're using, and you would find rich, wonderful, deep hymns. Many of them old, some of them new, that are being kept alive for a new generation. I love that. You should make that. Can I just say, you don't have to delete your cool, like, Jesus songs worship playlist, okay, that you like, you know, your newest song on there. I've got that. I love those songs. I just want you to add a few of those. Sprinkle them in. Don't, so that you remember you're part of something older than you. Maybe if you'd never done this, this would be something fun. Get a hymnal. I own multiple hymnals. I love them. I flip through them regularly to spark me in prayer, to help me to worship, to sing to Jesus in my office. And I think that might be a good devotional exercise for you. Maybe you should buy a hymnal, keep it at home, and sing some of those songs. And maybe you're somebody like me. So listening to this podcast, I, for years, chose the songs of worship for a congregation when I was a worship leader. And I look back on that. And I think if I could have done it again, I would have tried to be a little less creative. I would have thought less like, how do I make sure this Sunday feels new and fresh? And I would have looked and said, what are the 100 songs that I hope I can plant inside the heart of our people so that I give them words to say to God on the best of their days and the worst of their days? I would have thought less like a modern music producer, less like a production producer, and way more like a pastor. Because what God uses to nourish the souls of his people aren't just the words of a sermon on Sunday. They're the song that you sing the rest of the week. In some ways, the most memorable thing from every Sunday at Cornerstone is not the message that I preach or Troy preaches. The most memorable thing from this past Sunday for me was a song that now is stuck inside of my heart, inside my soul, that helps me to take my heart to God. So there's a few musings on the history of the hymns of the faith and on the value of singing these songs for generations. God, help us to be faithful, to take the truth of the gospel that we've received and to keep passing that truth and also the songs of the truth along from this generation to generations to come.